Hello, world. This is Allison Pipitone. In this podcast, we talk about music and those of us who do it for a song. Welcome to The Great Unsung. I wish I could put into words how amazing it is to sit inside the Buffalo Local 533 Colored Musicians Club. When the museum and the club are not open, you're sitting there. You can almost hear the history of this place. The voices, the beats, the laughter, echoes of history. You don't have to close your eyes because pictures of the jazz and R&B greats are all over the walls. It really feels like you're in a special and important place. I interviewed George Scott for this episode. George is the band leader for the George Scott Big Band, and he is the current president of the Colored Musicians Club. He was a gracious host on the morning of our interview. He's got a ton of information about the history of jazz and R&B in Buffalo and about music in general. I had a great time talking to him, and I appreciated learning a lot from him. We covered a ton of ground in the hour that we were together that day. I do want to mention the squeaking of the chairs, which you will hear them. We were both sitting in these awesome swivel office chairs, and we kept looking around the room as George pointed out some of the people on the walls and the displays and stuff like that. Let me put it to you this way. If I had a set location producer for my podcast, she or he would be fired. But since I was a one-woman show that day, I decided to give myself another chance. And so I just put myself on a two-day unpaid leave. So sit back, relax, and yes, feel free to swivel in your chair as you listen to episode 15 of The Great Unsung. All right, George Scott, thank you so much for letting me come here to the Colored Musicians Club and talk to you today.
It's a pleasure.
I hope you know how much I appreciate that, and I appreciate you. And
oh, thank you.
I want to start, I have some questions for you. I have like five different areas that I want to talk to you about.
Okay.
The first one is this. Jazz saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your first true love?
Well, you know what? I started out originally on guitar. You know, I was a guitar player much like you, and that was from my grandfather. Now, my grandfather, he played the blues and honky-tonk stuff. And, you know, he was just so cool playing that and everything. Even my father got into the guitar for a little bit. But like my father, he became interested in the saxophone. And that's what happened to me.
So sort of three generations of men who played guitar and got interested in the saxophone.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah. My grandfather stayed guitar through and true, but my dad and I kind of went from guitar to saxophone.
Really?
Yeah.
And so what era are we talking? What decades are we talking?
Well,
50s, 60s?
Well, for my dad, it would be probably like 40s into the 50s. My grandfather was, you know, 30s, 20s, 30s when he started playing.
And saxophone, your dad got into it and you got into it.
Yeah.
Is that because of jazz, because of the genre, would you say?
Well, I think it was just more the fascination of the sound, you know? Now, my father, he joined the Navy, and he was right there sort of between the Korean War and the Vietnam War. But he went on the ship, and I guess one of his buddies there played the saxophone and really well. And he was just so enthralled by that you know, he wanted to get into it. So he bought himself a saxophone.
So let me ask you this. Do you remember how you felt when you first started hearing songs on records or on the radio? Do you remember that feeling you had when you knew something about music really spoke to you?
Yes, I was very, very young, actually. You know, my older brother, who's 7 years older than me, he went to Hutch Tech. But even before that, he was playing the trumpet. And so every Wednesday night around 7 o'clock, his trumpet teacher would come to the house. In the living room, they would, you know, practice, go over the lessons and stuff. So that was the kind of the first bite of it. But when my brother went on to high school, he was in the high school big band. So he started bringing in all these albums. So I would hear Coltrane, Charlie Parker and stuff. And, you know, it was just the sound of that saxophone. It just did something to me inside.
What did it do to you?
Got me excited and really got me really like, wow, I would really love to be able to do something like that, you know, because it was so impressive to me.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I love the guitar and yeah. I love what my grandfather did, but this just struck me even more so than guitar did.
You said your grandfather played like
blues,
like yeah. early blues, right?
Yes.
So for you, jazz was like the cool teenager thing almost,
exactly,
wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, because my older brother was into it, and you know how it is when you have an older sibling, you yeah. kind of look up to yeah. the sibling, and that's how it was for me. And, you know, those riffs and everything, and it was like, wow, you know, it was talking to me, literally.
Yeah.
And then the coup de grace was when he played a Charlie Parker album. The speed of his playing, and it sounded like a hummingbird or something was flying around in the room. I told him, it sounded like a bird flying around. And he said, wow, that's funny, because that's his nickname, Bird, you know.
You went right to the source, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Can you tell me about Buffalo? What was Buffalo, the music of Buffalo, in what you knew at that time? What was it like?
It was kind of an interesting time because, you know, I was born in the late 50s going into the 60s. So, you know, my parents both being deacons and deaconess, naturally you had gospel going there, particularly on Sundays and stuff. But then the other thing was, you know, we had black radio. And so, you know, you had the blues and you had big band, and then you had music like Nat King Cole and stuff. So you had a sort of a variety of different types of music. And but the jazz, I didn't get to hear too much on the radio other than big band. But this bebop and that type of sound, yeah. that was only on my brother's record.
See, that's interesting. That was harder to get to at that time, yes?
Right, it was.
That was maybe more accessible.
Yeah.
More popular, you could say, with exactly. the masses at that time.
Yeah.
And the jazz was a little more edgy.
Yeah. For some reason, that kind of satisfied my soul mm-hmm. more than the other stuff.
And I've been trying to understand jazz. Like, I talked to Walt Kemp a couple months ago for this podcast. And for years, I love music. And I try to understand music that I don't quite get. And jazz is one of those genres. And I think I'm getting better at it.
Yeah.
As time goes on, because I was brought up in a very basic major key folk rock sort of background, which turned into rock, right? And
yeah.
blues, but that's all very, blues can shoot off in two different ways, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The bebop stuff is like a struggle for me to follow, to understand, to find out where's the center of the note. Because I think guys like you, you automatically hear the tonal note,
mm-hmm.
people are playing around it.
Yeah.
I don't hear it in my head. So
yeah.
Does that make any sense to you?
No, it does. Now, let me give you kind of a quick lesson in African-American music. Our bloodline, our heartbeat is pretty much based on the drum and the bass. In other words, the rhythm is the pulse of all our music, from gospel all the way up to hip-hop today.
Okay. Yep.
That's the backbone of everything. So whatever we write, it's going to be based on those things first.
Okay.
So we always start off with that rhythm. You hear guys humming, you know, doom, 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 and then they count off like that.
Yep.
And then from there, we then work out the counter rhythm to that bass and drum line. And then we flow with it. Okay. And again, as you grow up in that music,
yes.
you sort of, you know how that rhythm
yes.
is going.
It's, I hear it. Yes.
It's like, just think of yourself on a raft on a river.
Yeah.
So you just go down this river and the changes would be avoiding the rocks. Okay.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
I hear you.
Yeah.
That's great.
Uh-huh.
And your description was very good, which brings me to my next major point with you, and I think it's a good transition. I want to ask you about being a band leader, because you are two things that actually are very different. You wear different hats.
Mm-hmm.
One, the musician,
mm-hmm.
and it's your job to be your part of the river, right,
yeah,
that's going
right.
in. That's a very different hat from being the band leader. So I would like to take a few minutes, if you could, and maybe talk about what do you like about being the musician? What's good about that as opposed to being the band leader?
The musician is sort of like the free spirit, if you will, you know, because pretty much you sit down and whatever song is presented to you to play, you just go out there and you play mm-hmm. and you just express yourself and, you know, you work it. Now, as the band leader, it's your job to determine what's going to be favorable or likable for the audience.
So much, such a big job and mm-hmm. such a different job, right?
Yeah.
Starting with, like you said,
mm-hmm.
what's the audience going to like? So before the gig,
mm-hmm.
you're making some decisions, right?
Well, sometimes the decisions are made as I'm standing looking out there in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes it's being made after the first song or two.
Yes.
You know, because now I got to feed off of how the response are. Because if I hear like two or three claps, and that's my parents, I'm in trouble.
Oh, no.
You know?
So that means I might be in trouble, too. I hear that way too often.
Yeah.
Sometimes even my parents don't play.
Yeah, that's then they're really in trouble, you know.
Oh, part of it is song choice.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the end result when you finally get everybody up there on the stage. So
yeah.
much of it goes into it before you get to the gig,
right.
correct?
Yeah, yeah. But usually what I'll do, you know, depending on what the type of event it is. Now, if it's, let's say, an outdoor festival, you've done a ton of those. Usually outdoor festivals, you're going to have a good mix of age groups out mm-hmm. there. So you're going to have people probably late teens all the way up to, you know, 60s, 70s and stuff. So when you have a mixed bag, now I'll sit there and I say, okay, it's going to be a mixed bag. So I know in my book what I have and what would appease everybody in that book. So I'll start to pull out a bunch of numbers, and then I'll start to weed it down as I get closer to the gig.
Okay, yeah.
You know, now the first and last songs are always the most important songs in the set or in the gig, because the first song you want to get their attention right away. So it's got to be, bam, you know, spot on. Boom, you want to wake them up. Ooh, what's that? You know, that type of mentality. And then, of course, the last song, the same thing. You want to leave them with something so when they go, wow, that band was awesome. So you could have stunk in between the first and last song, but remember the first and last song.
I love that too. I love that concept. I'm in on that one.
That's right. Yeah.
What about personnel though? How do you, because I've seen your band plenty of times. You've got it. I mean, you're George Scott Big Band. No kidding about the big band. How
yeah.
many pieces?
17, and then I have two vocalists.
Okay, first of all,
uh-huh.
how do you get everybody to show up for the gig?
Well, when you have lots of gigs, it's easy for people to show up for rehearsals.
Okay.
You know, when you don't have a lot of gigs, then it's tough because then guys are going to be hunting around for somebody that's
making. Unbelievable. So you got a horn section, a rhythm
yeah.
section, keyboards?
Yeah, you have, well, it's five saxes. Then you have four trombones, four trumpets, and then you have four rhythm. So that you add that up, and that's 17.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a male and female vocalist, you know. Now, most people, they deal with one, but I like two.
Do they read music? Does your band read
yeah.
music?
Yeah, they read. But these guys could improvise off the fly.
What about being a band leader appeals to you?
Well, I guess since I was in school, I sort of kind of relished the role of being responsible and a guiding factor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know why that is, but I guess my father kind of instilled with me that, you know, don't depend on anybody to do it. You know, you do it.
Yeah.
This way you know the job is done.
Yeah.
So I guess that's been the mentality that was kind of groomed in me from the time I was young.
So you weren't afraid to sort of take the reins
no.
and take over. Did it sort of happen over time that you became a band leader? Did you start by being a musician in bands?
Yeah, I was just a young, in fact, you know, I was the youngest member in a lot of the bands up here at the club. And I mean, being the band leader was the furthest thing from my mind. And I was just happy to play and then go, you know.
Yes.
But one of the band, the leader of the band, his health and stuff was getting bad and looked like the band was going to dissolve, you know. And I saw a lot of these guys, they were like, this was their night to play.
Okay.
And if that would have broken up, I just felt like bad for these guys. And so nobody really wanted to take the reign of it or the responsibility of it. So I said, well, if you guys want to stay, I'll do it. So I just, at the beginning, just volunteered. Oh, that was like back in the late 90s, I guess. And so, yeah.
Okay.
So I said, well, if you don't mind, you know, I'll take it over and, you know, I'll run it. And so they said, okay, fine. And so that's how it started. So for the first maybe 2 or 3 years, we just kept the name of the band as it was, you know, and I just took over and started directing. And then I would say about 1999, 2000, you know, the guys in the band said, well, look, you know, we like what you're doing and we're having fun and it's great. And but we feel you should change the name of the band now. You know, this is your band now.
Okay.
So they were the one that kind of anointed it as the George Scott
they
Big
did?
Band.
Oh, yeah. I didn't. With my band, I just told everybody.
Well,
I was
gonna, you know. Yeah, right, yeah.
Gee whiz, I maybe should have waited.
Yeah, they told me it should be. And so I was flattered by that, and I said, okay.
Absolutely.
You know, and so that's really how the George Scott Big Band was formed from that.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
I have this note here. You wear a lot of hats. Musician, band leader, mm-hmm. president of the Colored Musicians Club, which I want to talk about next.
Okay.
But my question is this type of lifestyle good for your personality?
Well, you know, like I told you before, growing up in, you know, in my house and the way my father was, I mean, it was just like I saw him do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, besides being a dad and, you know, working a job, you know, he was very, very important for the church. And he wore a lot of hats there at the church. And, you know, mm-hmm. where he worked at, you know, he did a lot of stuff there. And then he was even working as far as in the neighborhood. He was on the block club president and things like that. So he wore a lot of multiple hats. So for us, it was just a natural thing.
I hear you. So it's sort of like the nut doesn't fall far from the tree.
Right.
You just, that's what you became.
I saw him do it, so I just figured, well, you know, I can do that too.
Yeah. Okay.
You know.
And I'm sure, I know your mother is still here with us and your father passed away last year.
Right.
I'm sure they were so proud of you, yes? Did they come and hear you all the time when they...
When they could, yeah.
Yep.
You know, they definitely came to all the festival events, you know.
Queen City Jazz Festival, yes.
Yeah, yeah, that, and they came to Canal Side.
Oh,
know.
Right. So let's talk about the Colored Musicians Club a little bit. First of all, I think we had this conversation a few years ago, but I want to mention it right now. I'm not sure if you know, but I'm white, okay? And so...
Yeah. Really? What?
I am.
Oh, my.
I know. So
man.
The first time that I started saying, oh, I'm going to the Colored Musicians Club, I felt a little bit... uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yes. Can you talk to me about the name, why it's okay?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me tell you this. Even black people feel uncomfortable with it,
really?
You know, or they ask me, well, why do you still call it colored? You know, why don't you call it this and that? And the reason we keep it as colored is the history of it, you know. It tells a story. Now, if we changed it and just said the Musicians Club or, you know, the Black Musicians Club or whatever, nobody would ask why. So keeping colored in the name brings that question up.
Beautiful.
And then from there, I get to tell the story.
Yes.
You know, the colored part is a homage to the founders of this union. This was started way, way back in the... early 1900s because of a law called segregation. Now imagine yourself being a talented musician, which you are, and in your case you're a woman, but let's say, you know, you were told that, well, you can't join this union because you're a woman. Now, you play just as good as those men on the stage, but because you're a woman, you're not allowed to do it. You know, it's like, well, I'm just as good, if not better. Mm-hmm. But that's the only restriction. So they fought for years and years until 1917, when finally they were given the, I hate to say permission or okay, but that's pretty much how it was, from the American Federation of Musicians
to form their own union.
Yeah.
So hence the colored musicians.
Right. And union. Again, that was law. You know, you had to define that you were a colored organization as opposed to just an organization.
Yeah.
And so that's how it was. So that certificate over there on the easel is the actual document that gave them the right to have a union. Okay?
Wow.
Yeah, that paper over 100, yeah.
Just for hard fought for just even for that document,
right.
Huge document, which
right.
still was one little part in the arc of history.
Yeah. But even with that, that really didn't hold a whole hell of a lot of beans.
Okay.
But this was the thing. They said that even though we had this union and we're free to do this and that, the other union, 43, which was the white local at the time, had first dibs on gigs around here.
Of course.
Because this was their territory. Yep. And whatever was left over or whatever, that's how it worked. But we had one thing going for us that 43 didn't have going for them. We could play jazz. Mm-hmm. And during that time period, particularly we're talking Prohibition and stuff, mm-hmm. jazz was the music of choice for these speakeasies, for these gambling places and, you know, even strip clubs and all that. That was the music of choice. And they didn't know how to play it. We did.
Okay.
And so that's what made this union thrive and mm-hmm. actually become a big, big deal. So after a short period of time, Local 533 was known all over the country.
So with that popularity, you got came some power, clout that you could make, that you could choose.
Right.
They would come to you for gigs, right?
Exactly, yeah. And then even better than that was we were bringing in big name acts like Dizzy over there and John Coltrane up there and Miles Davis and you know, Nat King Cole, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday, Aretha Franklin.
Are you telling me that those people that you just named, some of them were actually in this building at one point?
Not only were they in this building, but some of them were even union members. Yes.
I made a list, and I'm skipping ahead. I made a list of some of my all-time amazingly most famous people.
Uh-huh.
And I want to see, I want you to tell me if they've ever been in this room where I'm right now.
Okay.
You just said one, Billie Holiday.
Yes.
She was
in fact, not only was she in this building, she also, at one point, one of her husbands was a Buffalonian. So she actually lived in Buffalo for a short
while.
She
did?
Yes.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, be still. I gotta move on. Wes Montgomery.
Wes Montgomery been through here a lot, yes.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
Buffalo
favorite.
Was a major player. I mean, in other words, you're talking about New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Buffalo was a major player as far as getting that type of music through here.
The circuit.
Yeah.
Because people could make it from one city to the next
exactly.
in a day's drive, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Let me keep going. This one will just really get me. Nina Simone.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
Oh.
She's been here several times. In fact, there's a friend of mine. She was a professional dancer. And they had worked some dance routines behind her when she came to Buffalo.
Gee whiz.
Yeah, so she knew her personally.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And there was a couple of musicians that played behind her.
That would be scary to play behind her because she was so...
Yeah.
And she was took great. No prisoners,
no,
right?
No. And she could play a hell of a piano mm-hmm. and stuff. And she knew her music, too.
Oh, my goodness. All right, here's one for you. You said Aretha Franklin, though, she was here?
Yes. Now, Aretha Franklin, as a young child, came to Buffalo by reason of her father. Her father was a minister. The first church that he was given was here in Buffalo. So as a young child,
okay.
she started singing in the dad's choir.
Oh.
And then she went on to Detroit and became, you know, really big deal. But when she came back to Buffalo, you know, she would play here, and she registered here at the Union before she played around. Even okay. used musicians from time to time here. Now, here's the additional tidbit to it. Her mother came back to Buffalo. She became a nurse, and she worked at Buffalo General. She died here, and she's buried in Forest Lawn.
She is?
Yeah. So she would come back from time to time to visit the mother's grave, mm-hmm. and she still has some friends and family here in Buffalo. So Buffalo was definitely very sentimental to her. Like I said, over there in 2016, she was inducted into the Buffalo Music Hall of Fame.
Oh, you've got her. Oh, you've got her trophy here.
Yeah. Well, what happened? She couldn't make that particular event, so I was asked to accept it on her behalf.
George.
Yeah. So I got up there and got it, and so we were hoping one day that she was going to come back and pick up her award and get a selfie. But unfortunately, that never happened.
Hopefully, her spirit will come through and visit it every now and again. I hope.
Right. Yeah.
Etta James.
Etta James been through here?
No.
Yes. Yes.
Oh my gosh. Uh-huh. I can't interview because I'm just trying to process my favorite. Here's one for you. Frank Sinatra.
Yeah. In fact, let me tell you the story on that one. This was given from one of our old time members. Both Sammy and Dean Martin came to the club here. Yeah. Now, what was going on? Sammy was here, and they were in town. And so they knew if he was in town, he would have to come here to the club.
So you're saying Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra were looking for Sammy Davis.
And they stopped by here looking to see if he was here.
Did they find him?
Well, he wasn't here, so I would imagine they would have, Well, Frank got connections, if you know what I mean. So.
Yeah, Frank, come on in, Frank. Help yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, now.
But Charlie Parker was in here quite a bit. Dizzy Gillespie was here a lot. And
Monk? Is that Thelonious Monk?
Monk was here.
He had a crazy style, right? Like,
yeah. I mean,
he was another trailblazer.
Mm-hmm.
His style on the piano, everyone was like, what that just happened, right?
Yeah, I guess they call it like a free form or whatever jazz, and it could be kind of out there. Now, I tell you, another musicians that were in town that was a very hot player too, Charles Mingus.
Oh, yeah.
And in fact, Mingus taught a jazz course at UB. And one of our members who became a hell of a bass player in his own right, Sabu Aliona.
Yeah.
He was going to school there, so he was in his class.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That's incredible.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you about some of the other people whose pictures line the walls here. And maybe these aren't the names, the household names.
Yeah.
But can you sort of speak to the importance of their legacy and you have included them in this museum. That's mm-hmm. beautiful. But why were these people, maybe less famous, why were they so important?
Well, this museum was really set up and designed to talk about Buffalo's influence on the music scene. So it's not so much we're making a jazz museum to talk about all the big names, because everybody know about these people. So that we're not doing anything new that way. But if we can point out that this local person played with this person, or this local person wrote music for that person, now it gives a more local slant on the music scene coming from this way.
Yeah.
Particularly we want the kids, or really anybody, to have pride in what Buffalo produced. And plus the added fact that what Buffalonians of color produced on a national scene. Mm-hmm.
I have to tell you, I think of certain sacred places when it comes to music in this country and actually beyond the country. Like, I think of Grand Ole Opry.
Yeah.
I think of Abbey Road Studios.
Uh-huh.
I think of actually Graceland.
Right.
I think of Muscle Shoals.
Mm-hmm.
I think of Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
Colored Musicians Club is right up there in that pantheon, I believe.
You. Yeah.
It's sort of almost like sacred ground here to me.
Yeah, I feel it is too. I feel a spiritual presence every time I'm in this place, And I know these guys back there and many others are happy that this, worked out. because again, I heard these stories firsthand from these guys, and as they started to pass away, you know, again, I'm not no young chicken now myself, and I wanted to make sure that these stories kept telling themselves long after I'm gone. I mean, you go back there and Dodo Green, I don't know if you remember Dodo Green or not. Dodo Green from Buffalo, New York, was the first female to get signed to Blue Note Records.
Really?
Yes. And she toured all over the world. But the fact that she was that big a deal.
Okay.
You know, which was amazing. And she had a couple of albums that she did with some name musician behind her, you know. And then another person, Lou Hackney. Now, this guy was a bass player, saxophone player, and a school teacher. And this guy, he got to go to England and play before the Queen for Buffalo, you know. And, I mean, just different stories like that. That's the thing that makes it so amazing, you know.
I agree.
You know.
And thank God for you and your the board of the people who not only preserved this, but the museum is beautiful. For anyone who's listening, when you come to Buffalo, you need to come, yes, Niagara Falls, yes, Colored Musicians Club, and check out this museum and live performances upstairs. Yes.
I mean, it's really amazing when we get people from out of town, particularly from like New York or Philly or even Chicago, because they grew up seeing some of these special kind of clubs. So when they come here, for a lot of them, it's like, wow, this reminds me of home.
Okay, so it's authentic upstairs.
Yeah, it's authentic.
Yeah.
So they equate it with some of those big clubs that you hear about, you know, back during the heyday.
Yes.
And they say, wow, this reminds me so much of, you know.
Love it. You don't have any plans to change that, dude.
No.
Oh, yeah. Some of my information I got from a really great article by Nancy Parisi that she did for, I think, Buffalo Rising or something.
Mm-hmm.
But here's one thing I want to say. Speaking of upstairs, listen to this from Nancy Parisi. It was also a popular late-night spot for musicians to hang out after finishing other gigs in town.
Mm-hmm.
Members had their own special glass behind the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think I could get a glass behind the bar?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Sure you can.
Can I be like an in quotes member? I know I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
An honorary glass behind the bar kind of a member.
Sure.
Okay, sweet. Yeah. I'll even bring it and put my name on it. You okay. Just pop it up back there.
Yeah, well, it was funny because I guess back then he used to, be able to initial glasses. So a lot of the members started to put their name or their nickname on the glass.
Okay.
Now, down in the... in the storage room, we got all these old either beer glasses or whatever with the names of the members or their nickname, you know.
Wow.
And it was cool because behind the bar, they had a little shelf and they put the glass up there. And then as they came into the room, the bartender would see who it was, grab their glass, knew what their specialty drink was, and make it. So by the time they got to the bar, it was up there.
Now that's, wait a minute.
It was like class.
Come on.
It
couldn't
was
get
class.
Any better than that.
No. Oh, but Lord. That's how it was. So we got a ton of those glasses. And
I'm going to sneak down and add one more. We have
a few right over here if you want to see them.
But
it was cool like that. And that was the thing that was so special. Now, let me explain this picture and what you just mentioned a second ago. Back in those days, now, this was another amazing thing. Imagine you're a big-name artist. You come to Buffalo or any place as far as that goes, and you perform for an audience, and say the majority of them, if all of them are white, and they paid money to see you play. So it's not like, you know, you was just somebody they just pushed out there. Okay, entertain those people, boy.
Right.
I mean, they knew who this person was.
Yes.
They paid money to see this person.
Okay.
They know him by name. They respected him because they paid the money to see him. And then when it's all said and done, they weren't allowed to mingle with those people or eat or drink with those people. So this is why they had to... That's why you see them with suits and stuff. These guys, they came back from a gig, and this was the only place that they can go to drink and eat. So even though that was a bit of a downer, the plus side of it was you can see our guys mingling with these famous people, and they got to hear how we sound, we heard how they sound. They got to know us. We got to know them. They traded numbers and stuff. And that's how these guys started to, you know, come together and play together.
And this is how history gets made. The history of a city and the history of a country. Because our falling, our bad points, segregation, racism, forced black people to maybe to create a different community in this era, even sadly, not that long ago, that only strengthened it.
And that was a thing. And the thing that was even more amazing to me was as I talked to these guys today who lived through all of that, and the fact that they don't resent or have any kind of hate or whatever. I mean, I'm sure there's time where they were upset.
Sure.
But the fact that even though it was wrong and everything, they still persevered. And, I mean, you know, they play with mixed bands today, and they don't harbor any ill wills, you know.
Do you think that the music itself sometimes promised people a better future?
Well, I think, I think that's part of it. But I think probably the more important part of it is the fact that these people respect the music enough to listen to what, you know, these gentlemen did and how they played it. And they want to really respect and honor what they put into their skin that they put into the game. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
So in other words, if you had a young kid that followed you around and asked you, how do you play this chord? How you play that? You know, the whole thing, time that she's with you, she's trying to be as good as you. But at the same time, she wants to respect what you have, talent and everything else.
I do get that.
You know what I mean?
And
that's what these, you know, students, when they come in, that's exactly, they want to be respectful of the music and respectful of the person that taught them the music, you know. And for these guys, now that they're old, they want to kind of make sure that the music stays alive.
Yeah, I get that. And so, that's so important.
Yeah.
And I mean, how could it not stay alive? But, you know, sometimes I worry, but.
Yeah. But, well, I tell you, we get a lot of youngsters, particularly on a Sunday night, that's playing the jazz and some young singers, too. And then you have Zuri Appleby. I mean, she's a chip off the old block from her father, Rodney. And she plays the hell out of the bass.
Yep.
And there's another young lady that plays drums with Beyonce's band. She was a graduate of Performing Arts School. Yeah. So, again, we have young talent that's out there doing it.
I love that. The New York State National Register, right? That's an accommodation that was given to this club. What does that mean for you, for the community?
Well, I tell you, it's like a big load off my mind, because once you get a National Register, it kind of makes this building untouchable, you know, because it's known as a national landmark, okay? Its historic value is deemed so valuable that it's registered as a historic landmark.
So nothing, no one can touch it.
Right.
In other words, so if Chris Collins drives by and sees that there's fracking gas underneath this building and tells his buddy Donald Trump, they still can't touch it.
They can't touch it.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
They can't touch it. Yeah.
Okay. One more thing we're going to do. I sometimes do this with the guests I have on my podcast.
Okay.
And I'm sure you know this guy, but I sometimes just look up the name George Scott, and I see other people who are named George Scott.
Yeah.
Guess what? Guess who you're another guy with your name is? Baseball player George Scott. You know about him?
Oh, I know about him. When I was playing baseball, I would always get the comment. His nickname was Boomer.
Boomer, yeah.
So they called me Baby Boomer when I was playing baseball.
Are you kidding
me? Yeah, I'm serious.
Oh, that's the
best. I was Baby Boomer. Although when I got a little older, I grew out a fro. And I had this thick black mustache, so they would call me Reggie.
Oh, so you
had the Reggie Jackson.
Because
I was kind of built like that.
Yeah, because he was, so just a little bit about him. He got signed right out of high school to play in the majors because he wanted to take care of his mother.
Right.
He's from Mississippi. He said, because he was tired of, he was picking cotton by the time he was 9 years old. He said, that's all we knew.
Yeah.
He would be, he goes, there's nothing worse than being up at 4 in the morning waiting for the truck to pick you up and chop cotton from 6 or 7 in the morning till 5 or 6 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
He played Little League Baseball in his spare time. Now, this is what I want to ask you. But he was temporarily ejected from his Little League game because he was too good. Now, I want to ask you, were you ever kicked out of a band because you were too good?
Man, I never got kicked out of any band, you know. But I've seen some band guys get kicked out. But it was just more because of attitude than playing.
It's playing too
you
good.
Know? No, yeah.
So that probably, that maybe wouldn't happen in music, that you'd be kicked out because you're too good.
Yeah. No, typically when you get kicked out of a band, it's usually because you just became a smart ass.
Oh, yeah, or
sometimes
you think
you're bigger than a band.
Yes, you think you're too good.
Yeah. Now, there's a couple of stories. I was with some bands, and the one... I won't name any names. It was a vocalist. And, you know, when we, as a group, you know, like when it came to setting up or tearing down, everybody, all hands on deck.
But I know, where you're going with this story. Okay,
well, she started singing, and before you know it, you know, family and friends and boyfriends are, you know, making her out to be this big star, and, you know, she's bigger than us and everything, so... You know, all she had to do was just gather the mics and the mic cords. I mean, nothing really, you know, compared to what we were moving. But, you know, then she was too big for that. And, you know, then...
Was her name Natalie Pipitone?
No,
Was
no.
her name Holly Cristiano?
No.
Okay.
No. But, you know, so anyway, it just came out to the point where we had to cut bait and stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was that.
Hey, that's a good name for a band, Cut Bait.
Cut Bait. Oh, see, I give you a new band.
Oh, maybe can we form a band and we'll call it Cut Bait?
Cut Bait, yeah. You know.
Well... This place looks fantastic, and I appreciate everything you've done to help our community. Can people come and check out the Color Musicians Club?
Yeah.
Open to the public?
Open to the public. Now, if you want to check out my band, mostly practice on a Monday upstairs at 7 to 9.
Can people come?
It's free. Oh, yeah.
They can come to your practice?
Yeah, it's free.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, the rehearsal is sort of like a show anyway, because, I mean, it's tight. And
we
have a good time. You get the vocalist, the bar is open, so that, you know, you can order a drink and stuff.
Well, I appreciate your time. Nice talking to you. We'll do it again sometime?
Yes, for
sure. All right, talk to you soon.
All right.
So what do you think? Did you learn some cool stuff this week about Buffalo, about jazz? About George Scott Big Band? Who's your favorite jazz player? What are your stories? Please let us know. Write to us at thegreatunsung@gmail.com. We really appreciate all the comments we get from you. And in fact, we're working on an episode coming up soon that features you. So keep up the good work. Please go to George Scott on Facebook, like his page, make a point to come and listen to his music. Please make a point to come to Buffalo, New York, and go to 145 Broadway downtown and visit the historic Colored Musicians Club. I don't know about you, but I learned a lot this week. I learned that sometimes you don't have to name your own band after you, for example, the Allison Pipitone Band, because sometimes the band will come up with it on their own. The George Scott Big Band. I learned that the coolest places in town just might have, behind the bar, a glass with your name etched on it, and the bartender might know how to make your drink before you even get there. Wow. And I learned that when you're listening to jazz music, maybe, just maybe, the best thing to do is close your eyes, jump into the river, and swim. See you next time on The Great Unsung.